Hello and welcome to Symphonies and Snacks. I'm Lucy Ann Harrison, and those were some opening bars of Boulez's L'Amato Sans Maître, which was written in 1955. Symphonies and Snacks is where we discuss contemporary classical music and eat pumbe-based snacks. Well, hey, what more could you want?
Yay.
You may have just heard there, wonderfully geeky Anna Thomas, who is my guest for this week. Hi.
Hi. This is exciting.
So last week I had Kim Moore on. Who is a good friend of mine, and I realised I didn't do any getting to know you because I knew Kim and just assumed that everyone would. So, episode two, trying to formalise the format a bit more. Yep. I have questionnaire questions.
I'm excited.
I have a survey. This is something that Adam and Joe used to do on their podcast, and I was just like, good enough for Adam and Joe. But let's just see how this goes. So, first on my survey, how did you get here this evening?
I've forgotten. No, you took me on the tube. Lucy brought me here because I wouldn't have found it on my own. She didn't kidnap me.
I escort my guests to make sure that they attend. And then I do feed them. I fed
you.
Yeah,
we had a really nice dinner as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Question number two on my survey. I'm pretending this is written down. Shall I give away the podcast magic?
That's no, Lucy has no questions.
This is just in my head. If you were in a film, what genre of film would you be in?
Oh, animated. Because then there'd be more magic. And it wouldn't look odd. Or just a magical film.
Huh.
Fantasy, that's the word.
Fantasy film. Like The Labyrinth.
I've not seen The Labyrinth, obviously.
What?
I've seen no films.
What? We can't be friends anymore, get out.
Goodbye. Ideal film to be in would be the Lego Movie. So,
because everything is awesome?
Yes. Because it's completely excellent.
What was my next question? Question number three. I think I've got five on my list. On my hand. Question number three. What is the best thing you've ever seen on public transport?
I saw a drunk man fall off when he was asleep against the doors and then they opened, which was really funny when I was a kid. But I don't
really
think that's
cruel.
It's really mean. I don't think that can possibly be the best thing I've ever seen. But maybe it is. Which would be really disappointing because I get the tube every day.
Can I tell you the best thing I've ever seen?
Yeah.
Just because it's wonderful. I sat next to an old man on the tube and he had a very small notebook with him. And the pages were written one side in English and one side in French. Like little handwritten pages. And I leant over, like I glanced over to have a look. And it was a recipe for a love potion.
That's adorable.
I wanted to know more, but then I thought it would be weird. And I'd clearly read over his shoulder and you're not supposed to do that.
Was it the same thing in French? And in English?
I think
was he translating it?
I don't know. It was just, oh, I want to know more. But I have
to travel back in time and
ask him.
Ask the questions. That's the only solution.
What question was I up to? Had I done three?
Yes.
Question number four, cake or death?
Cake!
Yep.
What is that question?
Cake or death?
Like, death by cake is like the only way to go. But
it's Eddie Izzard, cake or death.
Well, I don't get your cultural references ever.
Oh. Question number five. I'm going to go serious.
Ooh.
What is a piece of music that you remember very clearly from your childhood? This is kind of relevant. Relevant? Relevant.
This is relevant.
Yeah.
But I feel like you should have given me this question in advance. When I was a child. How young?
Just any that sticks out. So for me, I have very strong memories of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, but also there's an Elvis song called Suspicion, which is just so dramatic that sticks in my head.
Well, ABBA Gold was the car CD, so obviously ABBA Gold, which is amazing.
Yeah. ABBA's
like
good.
The whole of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Can you do the colours?
Yeah, because when we did it, when I was a kid, I was girl who points at colour on coat as the song happens.
That's how I should have introduced you.
Yes! Why did you go for wonderfully geeky when you could have had that?
When I could have had girl who points at colours.
Yeah. Which I don't think has changed. Because often, well...
Quick, purple!
Yeah. Often I'm like, oh, blue. Or, ooh, sparkles.
Right. We are here to discuss Boulez.
We are.
But that was a very good getting to know you. I feel I know you much better now.
I'm glad.
So, the Le Marteau sans maître, we don't have Kim to do the French this week.
I also can't speak French. But you, is that going to become a thing?
It's those words there, Le Marteau sans maître.
Le Marteau. Well, you just said it. Le Marteau sans maître.
Yeah, I should just let you do it first. It was written in between 1953 and 1955 by Pierre Boulez. It is a piece of total surrealism.
I don't know what that means.
I got a really blank look, and that is why I have non-musical guests, because otherwise I'd just go, yeah, it's surrealism. Surrealism is when you use every single note. So we have 12 tones, and surrealism uses all of those tones.
And what's a tone? Because like, I basically know nothing.
A tone is a note.
Okay.
So we have 12 notes.
It's an anagram of note.
Oh, that's great.
Is that why it's a word? Are they like, oh, we've got these letters, but we can't choose which order to put them in?
If any entomologists out there? Etymologists.
Etymologists.
Etymologists, not entomologists. Know this, please. Do get in touch.
Yeah, definitely, because I'm really intrigued now.
And this is a really key part of 20th century music. It is written for, it's got a lot of instruments here, it's contralto soloist.
I don't know what that is. Am I going to say that after every one?
Yes.
Okay.
Probably. So it's contralto vocalist, which is contra alto. So contra meaning below, and alto being the lower female voice, so you have soprano, alto, tenor, bass in the full range of male and female voices. So the contralto goes between the alto and the tenor.
It's like the lowest female.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool.
There we go, it all makes sense. And then it's alto flute, so you've got your normal flute and then you've got alto flute, which is a bit longer. Oh, great word coming up. Xylorimba.
Is that across to the xylophone and marimba?
It is indeed.
Oh, just say you're wrong.
It's not a combination.
Is it not?
It's a xylophone.
You are wrong.
I am wrong. It's a xylophone with an extended range. So it's a bigger xylophone. Ah, do you know what? I haven't explained to people why I might be a bit scatty this week. I know I was scatty last episode, but this episode, I haven't slept.
All the excuses.
All the excuses. We had a carbon monoxide leak.
Lucy's been mildly poisoned.
And then I came into work going, oh, just, ugh. And I've been a bit weird all day and angry and tired. And then I decided to record a podcast. So yeah, xylorimba, xylophone with an extended range.
Good to know. Continue your list.
Vibraphone, that I know, that's a similar kind of percussive instrument that's got metal keys, but a vibraphone also has a motor to Ooh. Add a vibration to the notes.
That's fun.
They are a lot of fun, and you can bow them, so you can use the bow from a string instrument on them and get this really nice, glassy, ethereal tone.
That sounds cool.
It's a lot of fun. Then there's percussion, just
various. I know that word.
Guitar and viola.
Cool.
I have so many jokes because there's percussionists in that and there's violas, but I'm not going to be mean to them because I like those instruments. But there's a lot of meanness in orchestras sometimes, like what you call someone who hangs around with musicians.
Don't know.
The drummer.
I think I like her. I could say a lot of mean jokes, but I won't. Except this one, which I'm immediately going to say.
Yep, that's what I do.
It should be a mean podcast. Be one full of loveliness.
Yeah. Yeah. I failed. It was meant to be one full of loveliness and then I almost got poisoned. And that's my excuse for today.
You can be mean if, like, you've had near-death experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it works. I also spilled tea on myself and burnt myself. I told my French housemate, though, and she went, British problems.
The French are too, like, well-coordinated to be able to spill stuff.
Because I came downstairs having burnt myself with tea and went, I've burnt myself with my tea, but what I really want to feel better is a cup of tea.
It's a conundrum.
I know, that was the only thing that would work. Right, I think we'll have a listen to it and then we'll talk about the piece. How does that sound?
Great.
That was part of the first movement of Pierre Boulez's Le Marteau sans Maître, L'Avant l'Artisanat Furieux, which is Before the Furious Craftsmanship. I've realised that I didn't say why we're doing Boulez this week. So there's two reasons. The first is these pieces are very process-driven, and I know that you, Anna, really love kind of getting into the processes of things and how they work and
that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's really important to me, just to be like...
It makes sense.
The base of things. Yes. Yeah. Where does it come from?
Because you're from, like Kim last week, you're from a maths background.
Yeah, because, like, all your guests should be mathematicians because we're excellent.
I think I know mathematicians, scientists and geographers.
Yeah, well, that's a good group of people.
I'm not sure about the geographers, a lot of coming
in. I know,
in.
They're a bit iffy, but, like, you've got the scientists. Well, they're alright.
Hi, geographers.
Hi. Anyway, sorry.
And the second reason we're doing this is that on the 23rd, which is hopefully going to be the day after we release, that is Pierre Boulez's 90th birthday. Happy birthday, Boulez.
Happy birthday.
Pierre
Boulez. Hope you're listening.
I really hope you're not. So Pierre Boulez, he did this total surrealism work, which we're going to talk about a bit more soon. But also what he's known for is he was the founder of IRCAM in Paris. So IRCAM is part of the Centre Pompidou. It stands for L'Institut de Recherche et Coordination Acoustique Musique. But it's a research centre, and one of the main things that they are responsible for the research of, and which Pierre Boulez was very key, like instrumental in bringing forward,
Ooh, first part of the night.
Yeah, is interactive sound technology. So there's a very famous piece of software called MaxMSP, which was developed by a guy called Miller Puckett in the 80s. And that came out of IRCAM and their research. And it's also what my composition is. So without Pierre Boulez and his research and the development of IRCAM, I wouldn't have the work that I do now.
That's so, really cool.
Thanks, Pierre Boulez. You're responsible for this. Not for this podcast.
He sort of is, indirectly.
Yeah, so I do...
This is your fault.
Yeah, I do large-scale interactive sound design, so sound installations where you do stuff and it does stuff back and it's really cool. That's the basis of my work.
It does sound cool.
Yeah, So let's talk more. Is that enough about Boulez for now? He's a French composer, if you haven't... I don't think I need to add that in.
No.
He's called Pierre.
We also forgot to buy him a cake.
We didn't buy him a cake, and also we won't sing Happy Birthday because that's very much copyright. People hunt you down for Happy Birthday.
I've heard. I spent some time in prison for singing Happy Birthday once, so... So I don't think I want to risk it again.
No. Dark times.
Yeah, that's very bad.
So, the first movement, when I said it was total surrealism, I wasn't quite as detailed enough as I should have been about what total surrealism means. So, you know I said surrealism is, it uses all of the notes.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. What are all the notes? Because A to G is only like 8 notes. So what are the other 4?
They're split into semi tones.
But why are they all split into semitones?
They're not all split. This is just how Western music works. So we work on diatonic scales. So we go, if we go C to C, C, C sharp, D, D sharp, E, F.
Oh, F like on a piano.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So white and black keys on the... white and black keys on the piano. So it uses every single one of those in what we call an octave, which is the set for 8 notes.
But it's actually 12.
It's actually 12.
Okay.
Just to confuse it. But also, with total serialism, that also includes the harmonies. So how the notes are stacked work on these tones as well. And also the rhythm is serial. So it's just absolutely complete. People might know, they might be aware of Schoenberg is the one that you do a GCSE for serialism. This is taking Schoenberg's work and research into that up to the next stage. But it's quite a clinical way of working.
Okay.
How do you feel about the first movement, having listened to it? And we're not going to do all the movements. I made this mistake with Kim last week. It's a long piece. It's 8 movements. Is it 8 or 9?
I thought it was 9.
It's 9 movements. Do you know what?
It goes in threes.
Yeah. And each is based on part of this poem.
We should have read the poem.
Well, come to the poem. How do you feel, though, on first impressions?
I felt like it sounded like a story.
Like a story?
Yeah. And the story was in a wood. But that's just what I thought. I might be wrong.
That's fascinating. And it's a really open-minded view that you've taken of this, because what I think people generally do with serialism and this kind of contemporary music, this is the kind of stuff that people find very off-putting. And it's because it appears to be random and it's clinky-plonk, I think, is how people describe it. It's stuff over there and there, and it's just kind of doing its own thing. So you know
you're in the woods, which I'm not in very often, but, and you're alone and it's dark, and I don't think I've ever been in that situation, but I can imagine it.
Mm.
And it's just a little bit creepy. It sounded like that.
Wow.
I decided.
No, that's really cool that you came up with something descriptive for this, because people are really dismissive of this kind of stuff. I like it.
I like things to have stories, so.
Should we look up the René Char?
Yeah.
Right. I tried to get a translation of the poem so that we could compare it to Anna's great description of being in a wood. I like to think there were some elves hopping around.
Let's put some elves in there. They could be like the really blinky noises.
Oh, little elves.
And then they can have houses because...
Because elves need somewhere to live.
No, but because like part of it sounded like a dumb elf to me. So they're like visiting each other. But also because elves need somewhere to live.
So the only translation I've got is via Wikipedia, so I apologise if this isn't right. But L'Artisanat Furieux, the furious craftsmanship, this is the prelude, this movement to that. So this is before this piece, so maybe. But in English, it's the red caravan on the edge of the nail, and corpse in the basket, and plough horses in the horseshoe. I dream the head on the point of my knife, Peru. We could try it in French, but
I wouldn't know what was going on.
Yeah,
and but we don't could have, assume I was right.
We don't have Kim Moore here and her amazing French, so
I know. I'm sad about that.
So, if we've got the before the furious craftsmanship,
yeah,
we've got the bit before this. So, essentially, they could be in a woods.
Yeah, there's a caravan, and maybe they're on holiday.
But there's a corpse in a basket.
Okay, maybe they're having one of those, like, earthy funerals.
Okay.
Or they're burying a murdered body.
They're burying a body.
The elves.
Yeah. The elves are buried. This has taken a dark turn.
Well, what did you expect?
I thought I'd bring you here, we'd have a lovely chat, we'd, you know...
I've murdered an elf.
What?
That's all that's happened. I've forced an elf to die.
Oh, no. Anna!
I'm sorry, I'm getting distracted.
So, what other observations did you have about the piece? Did it seem... I've described serialism and I've described total serialism vaguely. I've not gone into great details about how you arrange the notes and stuff, but basically you put the notes in an order and you put everything in an order and it always stays in that order. And it kind of leaps.
Well, that's nice.
That's nice, that order.
Order is good.
Order is good. Did it sound that ordered?
No, it didn't sound ordered at all. It sounded like a mess. Sorry. Yeah.
I mean, it's fair point.
It did sound very messy.
Yeah.
And also just very, like, not smooth, which there is a word for, but not joined up.
Yeah.
Like, just things were just happening. And
disjointed.
Yeah, disjointed. Like, they didn't know that the other things were happening.
Like, everyone was doing their own thing.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that is a result of the serialism, because if you've got these pitches that are going, and if you've got the rhythm that's going on a loop, and if you've got everything just constantly going round in the loop, what you'll eventually end up with is processes that are just going regardless. So I suppose if you set three people tasks and you say to them, you've got to just keep doing this, so you're going to keep turning that crank. I'm thinking of turning that crank because I've been watching The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and that's a whole plot point. But you keep turning that plank, you're going to take these boxes and stack them over there. And then the third person, you go, you're going to, I can't think of the third process.
Tie knots.
You're going to tie knots in this piece of rope. And they're all just carrying on doing those things. They're going to carry on regardless.
Are all the things the same length?
I don't
think
so. Because
it doesn't sound like it repeats. I wasn't really listening to like, the individual bits.
I think the pictures are actually split between all the parts. So you have your notes and you have your tone rows, and then you split them between the instruments.
Okay.
And that's how it's orchestrated. So you take parts of it. We had to do, in my first year of my degree, I had a very tough contemporary music 2 hours on a Monday morning at 9 o'clock. And one of the things was we had to write something in the style of B. Leslie's using all the techniques that we're talking about today. So you had, or you made your tone row, and then you made your chords, and then you split them across the instrument, and that's how you made the variation, was by using the different sounds of the different instruments.
Mm.
So you use, I used this term last week, but timbre. So how the instruments sound to differentiate and to highlight different parts of it. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Kind of.
Do you have the piece you made that was based on this?
No, it was a group piece. So that was even more interesting, was we were building cells of music. And an interesting thing that Boulez used to do, this isn't used in this, this is a structured piece, but sometimes he liked to leave things up to chance, and he experimented with this type of conducting, which is also what we had to do in this, where everyone wrote a cell. And it wasn't that you wrote well, when I say cell, I mean like your maybe 20 seconds of music.
Okay.
And that's the cell.
Yeah.
And that exists on its own. So everyone wrote one of those. It wasn't that you wrote number 1, 2, 3, and they all went through. You numbered them all, and then the conductor just points at you. So the conductor...
That'd be so stressful.
The conductor will hold up, and this is a Boulez conducting technique, is you might have 5 cells, and he'll hold up his finger and be like, 1, 3, 2, 5, 1. And you have to just go with it.
Wow, that sounds so much fun.
So the idea is that it leaves it up to chance, and it leaves the order of the music up to chance, but there is a flaw in that, which is it's not even pseudo-random, it's relying on human
input. But you could have, like, a random number jump generator, and then, like, if it was, like, electronic, then you could just, like, write a program that's, like, generating numbers and then told it to go, and then it would just make its own... You could just leave it.
On that software that I described.
Is that what happens?
You can do random number generators quite easily. But they are, there's this whole thing about pseudo-random because, well, you'd know more about this than me, but because when you do the random thing, if it keeps throwing up 3 or it keeps throwing up a pattern, the way that the human ear hears things and the way that we order things, if there's any... There's something about humans are always looking for patterns.
Yeah.
So when you actually have a random number generator, you have to make it seem random rather than actually be random. So there's a whole load of like funny programming that you can put into it to try and stop it going like 1 2 3 1 2 3 2 1 3, like to make it more,
yeah,
even though that would be actually random. Anyway, so what I think what we'll do is there's three poems and it's 9 movements, but for each one there's an avant, so before, then there's commentaries on it, and then I've explained this wrong. For each poem, there's a return. So I think we'll choose one theme from each time a poem is used.
Okay.
So each poem is going to be featured once, but we're only going to talk about 3 movements because we've got some fun stuff to do. So we'll whip through those and then do some of the other fun things that I've got planned, which is based on this first year composition task.
Oh, I'm rewarding. Okay,
You're excited, right?
I'm excited. Before I even remember what we were doing, I got excited because you said fun so many times. Almost like you thought, like, this will be fun.
It's organised fun.
The best type.
Rules are what makes it fun.
Well, this is all about rules, so actually, yeah, that would make sense.
Serialism, completely about rules. And that's an interesting point with, we're talking about 20th and 21st century classical music on this podcast. Because that's my specialism. She says. Yeah. Contemporary music is what I do, but I'm a composer. But when I'm teaching classes, I teach more on the 21st century line. Like, I know about the earlier stuff, but I haven't gone as in-depth into it. But yeah, there's a really interesting point about this is about rules. And round about 1960, when stuff started getting... So this is 1955. Around about 1960, when things started getting drug-heavy. Let's be very honest about
that.
And there was a split in contemporary music between very, very rule-heavy and very, very controlled... ex-Darmstadt. So Darmstadt is the school where serialism was first developed. So there was that kind of very controlled rules, and then there was the absolute freedom of John Cage and the avant-garde. So we've got the rules, we've got the lack of rules. And now we're in this place in music where anything's fair game.
Well, that's a fun place to be. Wait, are there no rules? Or are there some rules and some...
You can impose the rules.
Okay.
So you can go, oh, I think there's a fight going on outside.
Oh, just, well, that's...
Just to tell the listeners, we said this the other week. We record in my house. I think there's a fight going on outside. So if you do listen to that...
It's because they don't like the lack of rules that happen later on in the 21st century.
They don't like the avant-garde.
No, really, it's where the split happened. They're on different teams.
Well, I think what you generally find is that you impose rules on your own work. So it's very useful to limit your own work and to set... When I work, I sit down and I set out all the parameters that I'm working within.
What, before you start?
Before I start. So I'll do like a page which I would treat as my own brief of, it's going to be this, 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 and it's not going to be those. So it's going to be a large scale work, it's going to be interactive, it's this type of interaction, it's going to use purely the sound from... I had a piece recently where it just used recordings of the girl guiding Promise. Yay, guiding!
Yay!
We've just come here from Brownies as well, so this is very topical for us. We're Brownie leaders together.
We are.
So those were my limits, and I was like, I'm not going to take any material from outside those recordings, and that's how I'm going to limit myself. Because so much freedom is actually really difficult to work within.
What, could you just go on tangents and
get lost? It's like too much for the human brain to deal with. You're just going, ah! So limiting is good. But yeah, this is all about rules. The rules are fun. This is going to be fun. But let's have a listen to, I'm trying to think which one we should do. We're going to listen to Commentaire de Bureau de Solitude, which is the second commentary on the Hangmen of Solitude. There's more than one hangman here.
I know, it's a little bit alarming, because also, then they're not in solitude. Like, are they... Like, solitude is alone.
Should we have a listen?
Yeah.
And then discuss what the elves have been up to?
Yes.
That was the fourth movement of Pierre Boulez's Le Motet sans Maître, Commentaire de Bureau de Solitude. I'm really not doing as well as Kim Moore the other week in her French.
I don't think anyone will live up to that, so...
She just had flair.
She did.
First impressions of that movement.
It didn't sound like Hangmen.
What would make it sound like Hangmen?
It would be less jolly. It was quite jolly. It wasn't in a wood. I'm not sure where it was. But it was a bit like, just sort of, la la la, like flink flonk, as you said. And I just don't think the hangman would be very flinky flonky. But it was quite solitude-y.
Shall we read the poem?
Yeah.
Yay, poem. So, Hangman of Solitude. Solitude. Not American. Solitude. Right. The step has gone away, the walker has fallen silent on the dial of imitation, the pendulum throws its instinctive load of granite.
I feel like the last word's always not what you expect.
More like Peru.
Yeah.
It is surrealist poetry.
What, so he just throws words in?
Yeah, surrealism is kind of like, hey, pig in a bowler hat. You weren't expecting that.
And that's what this piece is about.
Melting clogs.
You should, like, do art talks.
just me and the Tate.
Yeah.
The Tate Modern go, hey, water lilies.
It'd be amazing.
Crow stuck to a canvas. That's my favourite one in the Tate. I don't know who it's by, but there's one where there's a crow that's been speared to the canvas, and it's really like, oh, but I don't know what it means, because I get freaked out by the number of tourists, and then I leave. So I go and look at the crow, and then I go...
A little pop in, see my old crow friend, and then... Ah, people, a lot.
I don't really like people. Like, there are exceptions, but, you know, en masse.
I can see why.
They keep me away from the crow.
Wow.
This is what carbon monoxide does to you.
No, this is what you're like.
Right. How do you feel it represented that poem?
Well, I did sort of forget that it was about hangman halfway through. But like, it kept feeling like it ended. And then it just continued. It was like, had loads of like really final notes. Which I feel could be quite like hangman-y.
That's something similar to the Messian, the quartet for the end of time, that I discussed last week with Kim, with these false endings. And I think that's interesting because French composers.
Oh.
And I think they were linked. You can draw a line through a lot of composers. Like you can do, if you're a composer, you can do your composer family tree.
Aww.
Of all the people who've taught. So you go, you know, the people who you've learnt with, and then you can go back up through their family tree and be like, hey, I've got Louis Andriessen in my family tree. That's a big name.
Okay. Love this blank look at that, like,
yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm meant to be impressed.
It's a weird way of name dropping, is being like, who's in your composer family tree?
Well, like, who influenced the people who influenced you?
Yeah.
I see.
And who taught them and those kind of things. So, if you work with the good
people...
Do
we know if they had a connection?
I think they did.
Apart from the whole French composer thing?
Apart from, hey, they're French. Gosh, there's a picture of them together. I did a quick search for Boulez on Oxford Music Online, which is an online encyclopedia of music. It's subscription based, and it is, so if you've got a university library access, you'll have access to it. But the first thing that came up was a picture of John Cage, Olivier Messiaen and Pierre Boulez in Huddersfield together at the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival, which is a very big festival, but that's just really made me laugh.
That's really cool. And it answers our question.
Yeah, they did know each other. It's the bigger question is whether Boulez studied with Messiaen. Oh, yes, he did. So, yeah, you can draw a line through them, and Boulez and Messiaen were linked through the Paris Conservatoire, where Boulez studied with Messiaen.
Hey, so maybe Messiaen taught him about the false endings.
False endings. Do you reckon he went, hey, Pierre, let them think you finished
those tricksters.
Let them think you done. Why am I finding this so funny today? Right. He also divided his time, according to Oxford Music Online, between music and mathematics. And we're going to get to more of that in a bit.
Yeah, so that's why it's so, like...
regimented.
Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah. Yeah. So, composer family trees. They're a thing.
That's really cool. I didn't know that.
Who else is in my family tree? I think Michael Finnessy is in my family tree. He's another big name. He teaches at Portsmouth. And then some of the big electronic composers are in my family tree.
Do you get far back enough that you can be related to anyone if you try hard enough?
I've only done 20th century. I've only just done over a coffee with other composers going, well, they studied with this person.
Wow, you guys.
We're really cool. Yeah. That's what, if I had other musicians on this podcast, that's what it would turn into.
Yeah.
Just as going, oh, yeah, classic Cage.
We should do, like, a bonus episode.
Just me and other composers.
Yeah.
Talking like that. Yeah. I'm sure I'd get loads of downloads. Right. You brought up a really interesting point while we were listening to that.
Yeah, so Lucy was looking through Wikipedia, and there was, like, the music for it. Like, not for the whole thing, for, like, a bar.
I don't do all my research from Wikipedia, by the way. No, it was just the poetry.
We're also on the Oxford thing. But, yeah. And I just didn't feel like it sounded like something that was actually written. It just sounds a bit like... there was a bit of direction, but it's mainly just, like, just hit your instruments. Play your instruments. Just make a random music. Just sort of do what you like.
In order to sound that random, and in order to sound like that does, it has to be extremely structured and extremely notated. And that's a really weird dichotomy.
Yeah.
That those two things exist together. But if you ask people to play randomly, like if you listen to free improvisation, so free improvisation is when we just say to contemporary performers, kind of, improvise together as a group. That sounds really new agey.
Yeah.
It happens a lot at music festivals, and you can sit in some very good improvisations, and normally they use text as the starting point, or they've agreed something beforehand. Or you can listen to dire ones where no one's listening to each other and there's no space. And really what's missing in those things is space, because everyone improvises independently and doesn't listen. So what's interesting about this piece is there's a lot of space.
There is. And all the, like, random pauses.
Yeah, and that's because it's so structured.
Oh.
And so thought out, and the processes that are in place, that's the result of all of that. Yeah.
Because there is a lot of space. Like, even when there's music happening, it's not very much.
Yeah. It's sparse, and that's something else that it shares with, that Boulez's music from around about this time shares with Messiaen's, is it's sparse. Like, it's spread out, and there's a lot of respecting the space of other instruments and not overlapping so much and things like that. And I think we get very used to this, what I would call a Wagnerian style. So huge orchestras.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of style that's used for a lot of film composition. So John Williams has these huge pieces and huge orchestras where it's kind of this behemoth of sound. Yeah. I don't know if that means anything. You know those very big scores. Or Murray Gold's music for Doctor Who. These huge scores. But actually, those are throwbacks to, you know, the 19th century.
Yeah.
That's very linked to 19th century composition.
But I feel like a score that was like this would sound really odd in most things. Like, imagine if it was Doctor Who, and then this was just happening in the background.
Hey, if they hired me.
This would be what it would be like.
I think that's because you're used to hearing that kind of music. That's honestly my view. If you had the right film, this would work well.
Yeah, I'm not saying it would work for any film.
Yeah.
But it would seem very odd in, like, Doctor Who. Although, I guess,
I don't
kind
know.
Of a bit alien, so.
Earlier Doctor Who, like, the really classic Doctor Who.
Like, 1960s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were a bit more experimental with this. So that was when the BBC Radiophonic Workshop was still a thing. So the Radiophonic Workshop does exist now, but in a different guise. But back then, when Doctor Who started, they provided all the sound effects, and they were a research centre. And there were some great women who worked in the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and I don't think we talk about women in electronic music enough, just to go off on a tangent, like a favourite tangent.
No, I feel like I never mention women in electronic music ever.
But to go off on, you know, one of my favourite tangents, there are two fantastic women who were very famous for the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and they're Delia Derbyshire and Daphne Oram. And they were responsible for so many of the sound effects in Doctor Who, but also in the opening theme, the original opening theme, the arrangement with the theremin and all the really weird electronics going on is Delia Derbyshire.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. So I think in earlier Doctor Who, they'd have used this kind of stuff, and this was really new and cutting edge when early Doctor Who was coming in. So I think it would work in early sci-fi, but I think we've got very used to that Wagnerian sound for all our films. Yeah, shall we move on to the third movement that we're going to discuss today?
Yes, let's.
I realised that we hadn't done one yet with the contralto in it, having spent all that time defining contralto. So this is the movement number 9, La Marte sans maître, Bel édifice et les présentiments du bleu.
What's it mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is stately building and presentiments again. Part of Movement 9 of Le Marteau sans maître by Pierre Boulez. That was Bel édifice et le présentiment du bleu. So that's the first movement we've come across with vocal. How do you feel about it, Anna?
Okay, so I heard her singing at the beginning and then I just couldn't hear her singing all the way through. At least kept being like, there she is, and I just couldn't hear her. So
it was an interesting thing, and it's an interesting writing technique, and it's very unusual actually, because normally you sit the vocals to be on top of everything, and having words makes the vocal part different, but she was part of the instrumental texture, so she was kind of humming notes and she was doing parts the same as the other instruments.
She was talking at the beginning.
Yeah.
Was she reciting the poem?
I'm not in... I don't know.
Sorry.
Should we read the poem?
Yes.
I like reading the poem.
You do?
I'm not very good with poetry. So stately buildings and presentiments. I hear marching in my legs, the dead sea waves overhead, child the wild seaside pier, man the imitated illusion, pure eyes in the woods. Are searching in tears for a habitable head. There you go, in the woods.
See, I knew that this was a poem about woods.
I imagine she was singing those words. That's terrible that I didn't pay enough attention. But the interesting part for me was when she then took on the role that was exactly the same as the other instruments through humming, and she matched them on the dynamics, so how loud she was, and became part of the texture, and that's very, very unusual for vocal writing to treat them exactly the same.
Yeah, it's really interesting though, because I didn't even notice she was doing that, but that'll be why.
And it's also because the choice of the alto flute with the contralto means that the flute and the voice were taking up the same space note-wise, so they had similar range.
Yes.
So they could go as high and low as each other. Meaning that they're not identical, but they do start to blend in places. Yeah.
It's
interesting techniques.
It didn't sound very stately. If what, that's its title.
What would make it sound stately?
Oh.
No, I'm just intrigued.
Not sounding like that. I don't know, it just sounds... I don't know if that sounds a bit common. It doesn't sound very posh, which is what stately should be. I think it might be because it's broken up a bit, and a stately thing would be more jointed and coherent.
What did you think about the flutes playing in this movement?
What were the flutes doing? Because I just don't know what the instruments are.
The flute did some flutter tonguing.
What's a flutter tonguing?
Yeah.
That sounds interesting.
So can you roll your R's?
No, can you?
Yeah, because I can flutter tongue as a...
Ooh. You play the clarinet.
We discussed this at length last week, me and Kim, but as a recorder player, that's a technique that we use. So instead of just blowing down the instrument, you give it a...
Do you do that on the clarinet?
You can do it on the clarinet, but I'm not very good at doing it on the clarinet. It is better on a pipe instrument, like the recorder. I can demonstrate. Last week I introduced my clarinets, Annie and Clarabelle.
Which one's this? Oh, is there...
These are the recorders. I haven't named the recorders. But they are rosewood. Both of them. And they match each other. Which I would like to say isn't intentional. But
you never play them both at the same time.
No, you play them... Oh, sometimes you do.
You do?
Yeah, like one in each hand.
But then you don't have enough fingers to cover all the notes.
Yeah, you just do like the first three. So flutter tonguing. So you've got your normal tone, which is... Probably not in tune because I've just picked this up and it's cold. Or you can give it a...
Ooh.
And that's flutter tonguing. And there's loads of that in this movement. And that's a nice extended technique.
But that makes it less stately.
Doing that.
Because it's just a bit... croaky. No like offense to your flutter tongue.
Like, I suppose if you had the British Grenadiers, like... That's stately.
Yeah.
Not at that speed. That sounds like a leprechaun playing it.
The elves are back. It just sounds a bit off. Sorry.
Does it sound like the Daleks have got it?
Yes. I'm like the Dalek with a recorder.
I'll put my recorder away.
What's your wand for?
Huh? That's to clean it. Yeah. So that's my lovely treble. My descant is also rosewood. And my brother broke it 2 weeks before my grade 8 recorder exam by sitting on it.
Wow.
Broke the foot joint.
I assume you were really pleased with him for that.
I like to remind him of it often. And we will get to Chris in a bit. My brother, Chris. Soon.
Soon to be your brother.
Soon to be discussed. Yeah, so that was a nice technique on that. I don't think, apart from the handling of the voice and the extended techniques, so the extra techniques used on the wind instrument, I don't think there's an incredible amount to discuss. Apart from halfway through, I just went, oh, I love a gong.
Do you love your gong?
I love a gong.
I hadn't actually noticed the gong when Lucy said that. I think that just might be a reflection of how much attention I was paying at that point.
Yeah, love a gong. It just sounds really dramatic. Anyway, we have reached that point in the show where we're going to take a break and talk snacks.
Snacks!
Pun-based snacks, which, as we said the other week, is the base, like, where the idea from the show came from is hashtag baking composers, which every now and again I try to get going. So the other day on the train, and I tweeted this from the show account, I had Chopin raisin
for my breakfast. I did not see that.
I had a Chopin raisin. But I struggled this week with this piece to come up with some puns. So
I've forgotten what the puns are.
It's okay, you're not supposed to know at this point. So my first one is, you know, in French, when you get a big thing of bread?
Yeah.
Like a big round thing of bread?
Yeah.
That's a pan au boulet.
Oh, because he's French.
Because he's French. And it's a boule. Pan au boulet. And then it's... Then I've got to go on our pan au boulet. Marmalade sans maître. And the lovely marmalade that I've got... I'm finding this hilarious.
That's great.
The marmalade that I've got.
It's not even proper puns. I know that puns are just similar sounding words, but.
I've not even done it properly this week.
No. I feel let down.
The problem is, I didn't have any help this week. So normally, I kind of test them out on people beforehand. I didn't.
Was a flaw.
But the marmalade that I've got, I could have got any marmalade, but it's got Paddington on it. Because if you're going to have marmalade...
Yeah, it's the Paddington. Most important marmalade. And I'm excited because I've never had marmalade.
Yeah, it's a learning experience.
That's what I'm going to have taken away from this
And
podcast.
Then we've also got some Cadbury's marvellous sans maître mix-ups. I'm so ashamed.
You look so proud. There is no shame here.
It's been a long week. This episode almost didn't get recorded. So I think we're going to take a pause. We're going to eat some marmalade. And then we're going to talk about, very briefly, about some other things.
Yay!
Yay!
Snacks!
Things! Right, so we decided not to eat entirely on audio because we did that with Kim last week and I realised I just had 15 minutes of me and Kim eating and we weren't quiet. It was just us eating. Anna, how did you find your first try of marmalade?
Well, I got it in my hair, but I really enjoyed it. Well, it's no jam. Let me say.
It's no jam. Yeah. What a review.
No, if you were to rank spread,
sorry,
it would be
marmalade sans maître.
I'm very proud. I think it's above Nutella, but
oh,
below jam.
Oh, that's high praise indeed.
I'm not a massive fan of Nutella.
Did you know that one jar contains all the nutrients that a bear needs for his day?
Ah, reimagine like Winnie the Pooh, but with a jar of Nutella instead of honey, like the branded version. It'd be well cute.
Or Paddington with actual marmalade.
Or real bears.
I think I need to educate you on Paddington.
We saw Paddington.
He lives on marmalade. Maybe he's a fan of boulets.
I think that's the only logical conclusion we can draw here. Paddington was a very cultured little bear. Because Peru...
Peru, which just pops up in Shah's poetry.
Peru. Just the word Peru.
I love surrealism.
Yes.
So I thought this section, I was umming and ahhing about what to do with the snack section, besides from make amazing puns, and I thought it's a chance for our guests to talk about anything that they want to talk about. but also a chance for us to catch up on what's going on in the world of Twitter, which at the moment is Christopher Harrison. You may notice that if I'm Lucy Ann Harrison, Christopher Harrison, it's a common surname, but he might be related.
Might be.
He might be. My brother has launched a campaign to be on the show.
I think that's quite high praise for your show, that people are campaigning to get on it. But they're not just like, can I be on it?
He sent me messages the other day with every letter of the word please repeatedly sent in a separate message.
Oh, like a surrealist piece.
Yes. But he really, really wants to be on this show. He has offered to bring in Mozart's balls. Ooh. If he's on. Oh, it sounds ridiculous, but Mozart's balls you can buy in Austria. And they are chocolate-covered marzipan with a picture of Mozart on top.
You're right, it's not ridiculous.
And they're great. They're not pun-based. He's also been demanding which pieces he would like to go through on the show, but at the moment he's only named film composers. So it's something we'll work on. But what I want to ask my guests in this slot every week, until we've made a decision, is Chrissy Yay or Chrissy Nay?
Chrissy Yay, because I don't want to be responsible for someone being let down. Hi, Chris. I like you, even if Lucy doesn't want you there.
I just thought, you know, I don't want it to be nepotism. I want to leave it up to the public vote. So there you go, that's one vote, Chrissy Yay.
I didn't get in by the public.
But you're not my brother. So that's one vote for Chris. If you'd like to get involved in the discussion on Twitter at Symphony Snack, we've got the hashtag Chrissy Yay or Chrissy Nay. So hashtag Chrissy Yay if you want him to be on, hashtag Chrissy Nay if you don't.
I'm going to tweet later.
he's campaigning as well. He's really working on his support. God bless you, Chris. Yeah, Chrissy Yay. Is there anything else you want to discuss here? Any great puns that you've thought of? They don't have to be related to this.
I'm sure I have thought of great puns, but not one that I can bring to mind.
I did a great one the other night without realising.
What did you do?
Somebody sent had put a picture up of a sad dog, and I went to someone, oh, look at that dog, it's really melancholy. Melancholy. Yep.
We all got it.
Yep, so I was proud of that.
I feel like you should tell people if suddenly going to be like, one of the best puns you've ever said. Because I don't store them.
Is that one of my best puns?
I don't think that could be counted as best.
Because my favourite that I've ever come up with was Prelude de Pré-Midi d'un Flan, which is a piece by Debussy, Prelude de Pré-Midi d'un Faun, and I liked it because it was so terrible.
I'm really glad you're getting a PhD in like music and this is what you're using your time for.
I sit in post-grad seminars and this is what I'm thinking of. Incidentally, if you've had some baking composers' snacks and you want to send us a picture of us, me, a picture of your pun-based snacks that you've been eating, I'd love to see it. That'll make my day. At Symphony Snack on Twitter.
I'm gonna do that.
Just send me pictures of your food. Yes. So something that we didn't bring up before with the Boulez, which I wanted to save because I thought you'd really love this, is how he developed the harmonic material for this. So how he built the chords up for this work.
Okay.
Are you excited?
I'm so excited, you don't even understand.
So what he did was something called chord multiplication.
Ooh.
Which is based on modular multiplication.
I really enjoy modular multiplication.
Do you want to explain modular multiplication to the people back home?
Okay. So it's when there's only like a set amount of numbers you can use. So when you get to the end, they just repeat again, like days of the week, like you get to Sunday and then you're like, oh, it's Monday again.
Like a tone row in music?
Yeah.
Because you got the 12 notes, then you go back round.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. So like this piece of music.
Yeah, it's like the remainder, I guess, if you were to divide by, I guess in this case, 12.
Yeah.
That's how you work it out.
So, I have some manuscript, which is the paper that we use to write music on. And I thought we could have a try at this.
That's going to be great on a podcast.
Well, we're going to have to talk through it.
Thank you.
So what we need to do is you pick a note to start on.
A.
We can play this afterwards. Shall I get my... I'm a terrible musician as well. I don't have a piano because I live in London and can't afford anywhere where you could fit a piano.
I live in London, they don't allow pianos in.
No, it's because of all the Cockneys having sing-alongs around the piano.
They just banned them. Apart from in stations, where occasionally there are just pianos just for fun.
Where people play... I almost said something. I won't go there. Right, so we have... Oh. Right. Okay. So we've got the C. So we're going to start on the C, and then we're going to label all the notes up from there. This is getting very technically, musically, jargony, but I've made it better by just talking nonsense.
Yes, thank you. Although I do know what, like, C and notes mean.
Yeah.
Also label. May I have a pet?
Oh, sorry. So you write down your 12 notes of the scale. This is me getting all Blue Peter-y. This is my Blue Peter audition.
Well, because on Blue Peter they do chord modification.
They do everything. Ah, but you start your labelling at zero. So label all the notes on the way up, but you start at zero. So zero, one, two.
Am I meant to be doing this too?
You don't need to. Okay. Well, five, six. Don't need that one. Anna has just put her head in her hands in shame, like in dismay at my academic rigour.
Suspected more.
So, what we're going to do is build some chords.
Okay.
Which of these notes do you like the look of?
A.
A. Right. Let's make them 2 4-note chords.
Okay.
So, I've got an A. Where do you want next?
8. Which is...
A G sharp.
Yes.
So, I've got a G sharp, I've got an A.
An E.
An E. And it's like countdown.
H sharp.
I want to put a D in.
I was going to say D, but then I feel like they're all too close.
No, close is good. So. Oh, hello. We have. That's nice.
It is. Go us.
Let's try this. Nice. Clashes. I like it. So we need a second chord.
Can we use the same numbers twice? Letters? Notes? Twice?
Yes. Yeah, we can. Well, actually, if we're doing this in a total serialist way, we should probably only use them once.
Okay, so we have C and F sharp and F.
So I'm going to make that a G flat and an F because it just looks neater to write it like that.
Okay, and what else have we not used? A B.
A B. So. Oh, I like that.
That's a bit creepy.
Well, because that's got a tritone
in a nice way.
Yeah. So now what we need to do is cross multiply. So this is like when you multiply with matrices.
Which I also really enjoy.
Matrices.
That's a multiply matrices song that everyone knows.
That's my matrices song.
Didn't come prepared with a matrices song.
Sorry. So we cross multiplied to get our final chord.
Okay.
Do you want to? Should we just talk through it, or do you want to?
We're going to have to talk me through it because I don't know how to do it.
Okay, so the D that we've got first is number 2, and that needs to multiply with the C, which is 0.
And 2 times 0 is 0.
So that goes. And then the two times we've got an F, which is 5. So that makes...
10. This is such a good, thing.
So we get a B. Because that's note number 10. And then the D needs to go for the B flat. So that's 2 times... No, that's a G.
That's a G. That's a 6. Because it was going to be an F sharp.
Yeah, so 2 6 is 12. So we go right back down to 0. So we get a C.
Why do we ignore the original 0?
Because 2 times nothing.
Well, so 2 times nothing is 0, but 2 times 6 is also 0, but one of the zeros counts.
Because that one's actually 12. Because you've got it repeated.
Okay.
Yeah. So that note that I crossed out and said, don't need that.
We need.
I actually need that. So that's 2 times 6 is 12. And then it needs to times by the B. And the B is... 7.
So it's 2.
Yes. Which is a D, but it's the D higher up because it's actually a 14.
Yes.
Yeah. That goes 10, 12, 14. So that's with the first row. So far we've got 3 notes because one of them's cancelled out.
So we could have 16 notes.
Yeah, you're going to get a really big ass chord.
What if it just has all the notes in it?
All the notes! That's a risk you take. So far we've got... Oh, that's too high. Yeah, so we've got a... Beautiful. Nice cluster. Yeah. So then we repeat. How do you feel this is working as a technique for you, by the way?
It's really interesting, because it's maths. So there's no maximum number of notes in a chord?
Nope. So I tried playing this on an app, but my app doesn't go far enough, and as a music student, that's pathetic.
And now it's like we're composing a real piece because the software is out.
For music geeks wanting to know, I use Finale. I don't use Sibelius, it doesn't work for me. Right, so we have... Our chord in the end has a C. This is after we've combined the two chords. Then we have a G sharp. I've got an A. I'm liking this.
That's pretty exciting.
I got a B. This is a big chord that we've written.
It is. It's beautiful.
And then you wanted that high E.
Yeah. I mean, I can make the E like that, but that E's fine.
Right. Can I hear your final chord?
Yes.
You're going to slow down.
Okay.
Yeah, so slow down. Oh. If I was really messing about with that. Because then, when you use these kind of processes back then, you use those processes, you stuck to those processes. Now you can have a little bit of a fiddle with it. So I would maybe put in, add some bass notes. Just to make it sound a bit richer, so then you get...
But you don't have the sparseness.
You don't have the sparseness. I quite like that sound, though. So, back then, it sounds really rude when the guy's still alive, still working, still present in the music community, but in 1955...
It's only an hour until his birthday!
We're recording this very
not
late.
Not until his birthday, because it's not tomorrow.
No. So in 1955, when you used these processes and when you did serialism, you had the process and you stuck to it. Now, in this kind of we don't really have rules world, which I know you find so frustrating.
Yes, not okay.
If you don't like it, you can mess with it and make it sound how you like.
Which is nice.
It's nice. I kind of sometimes feel it's cheating. Like, I do it and go, that doesn't sound how I wanted, so I'll just tweak that note.
It depends. If you're like, oh, I'm going to write a mathematical equation or use a mathematical formula to write a thing, and then you get an answer and you're like, nah, then that's cheating. But if you just compose something and then you're like, I could make this better, then it's not.
There we go.
That's my take on that.
So I think that's all we have time for. I need to let you go. I need to stop this kidnapping now.
You do. And I need a wee.
Thanks for sharing.
Sorry.
You can follow the show at Symphony Snack on Twitter. We tweet baking puns. That's what we do. And my brother's campaign to be on the show. That's what we've tweeted so far. And then also some interesting articles. There's been some stuff out this week about female composers. We've been tweeting that. Because, well, I'm a female composer and I care about that. That's what you get. Anna, are you on Twitter and would you like people to follow you?
Yes. I am _ Anna Thomas. And I just tweet a lot and then I don't tweet very much and it's all very random. It's great, basically.
And Anna's very young and understands things like Tumblr.
I do. I'm not going to share my Tumblr with you guys. But
yeah.
But I understand it.
You can also follow me personally at LA Harrison Music. That's where I tweet about my composition work, works in progress, girl guiding and cakes what I have baked. I won a baking competition recently.
There were some very good cakes involved.
I won a picture of Mary Berry.
Yeah, but I got a picture of Sue Perkins without having to make anything. So I feel like I won. Plus I got one of your cakes.
Yeah, well, yeah. There was no pun, but I did stick terrible jokes in the top of each one. Shall I tell a terrible joke before
we go? I have one of your terrible jokes now stuck to my computer monitor.
Ooh, which terrible joke shall I go for?
The fridge one.
For your favourite. How do you know if there are two elephants in your fridge?
I don't know.
There's giggling when the light goes out.
It's just such an excellent image.
Thank you for listening. I'm Lucy Ann Harrison, and this is Symphonies and Snacks. And here is some more of the Boulez to see us out.